Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is a first installment of Concave Earth Sessions. I thought I'd start a little session discussion with two of my friends here, Damian Nix, who's a prolific writer, and he recently found my work on YouTube, and so we started up a little discussion. And we also have John DeVoe here, who is another concaver who actually started a Concave Earth blogspot, which is has some really good, interesting articles on there that backs the Concave Earth. Why don't we start with John? John, why don't you introduce yourself and just kind of go from there, I guess.
All right. Well, as you said, my name's John DeVoe. I get interested in a lot of different topics, and one of them was the flat Earth, which eventually led me to the concave Earth with experiments like the rectilinear. And then, of course, I met your videos along the way and decided it was about time I start writing about it.
Excellent. And you and I've we had a few discussions already. And what is you've been telling me that you've actually been interacting with people like just like friends, family, just people at work or whatever. And what has been like their general response to the concave earth concept?
Well, it's foreign to many people. It's hard to get past what's been taught in schools, and it's hard to open your mind in a lot of ways. There's a lot of primary foundations that are not easily accepted, and because of that, you kind of got to work at trying to explain to people where concave Earth makes sense. And though we have the data to back up what we're saying, we still have the opposition because of people going to college and physics and other things. And not that education is bad, but it seems to create compartmentalization to other ideas. So, my experience is you have some people who will listen to you and they find it extremely interesting. And those people generally hang on to the idea for a while. And then you have the other people who just immediately want to ridicule everything you say.
Right. Do you find that it's they're less inclined to ridicule you when it's face-to-face contact? Because it seems like when people have the filter with the internet, it seems like they feel more comfortable ridiculing or mocking the concept. But it, like when you're in when you're in your when you're face-to-face with somebody, and you're just telling them the facts that, you know, number one, the Earth, there's no proof whatsoever that there's any rotation to the Earth, or, you know, I think it. To me, anyway, I think that it when it's usually it's when it's like a one-on-one confrontation or just discussion with somebody, I think they take it more seriously and they respect you more, I think. Is that what you find too, or?
Absolutely. Face to face is so much easier than, on places like YouTube or commentaries online. And the reason being is because I can, in front of you, show you examples. I can explain to you and give you, I guess, a better visualization of what I'm talking about.
Right.
Better comparisons, things like that.
Let's go on to Damien. Damien, why don't you introduce yourself and just give us a little bit about information about your background and how you came about to know the concave earth.
Sure. I'm Damian Nix. I run just a little blog called altnews.info, where I cover esoteric, strange subjects of all types and memory hole articles from media, just to kind of preserve the memory and history of whatever's going on at the time. So I came across the concave earth theory when I first read an article in Omni magazine. It was called The Hollow Earth Theory, the Maddening Theory That Can't Be Disproven.
Right.
Basically went into Cyrus Teed's work and the rectilinear era as well, basically proving a few different aspects, saying that basically, hollow earth could be proved with inverse geometry, which I found intriguing because math is always, kind of
Right.
extremely
So you've heard
important.
of Mostafa Abdelkader, that Egyptian
Exactly, yeah. Exactly,
mathematician.
yep. Yeah, so they went into his work and found that, you could basically make the same argument for a concave earth as you could for a convex earth. So that stuck with me for quite a long time. And then last year I had this really vivid dream about basically looking at the mechanism that worked the earth, you know, like it almost felt like an Ezekiel's wheel kind of revelation in this dream, mm-hmm. where I could see the inner workings of the planet. And then I basically, I know it was like I was intrigued by that, and it's been kind of haunting my memory for a long time about that. And then I found your videos, and I saw basically how you put it all together in this elegant, you know, graphic form that you can basically get your head around really easily. You can see how it functions, and you can see, you know, the rotations and the, you know, mm-hmm. the different movements of celestial bodies in a rational way. So I kind of latched onto it that way, basically.
Awesome. So, what do you think? I mean, as far as like, I think there's a lot of concave people that are kind of like just in the shadows. They're just kind of, you know, they're like afraid to like actually step out and tell people about the concave orb because of the, you know, the obvious ridicule that people would give them. But
you have to think you're surmount. You know, you're trying to surmount like decades and centuries basically worth of ideology, you know. It's a scientific, you know, what they've proven, like I said, is basically the truth the whole time, mm-hmm. you know.
Right.
It's been accepted in that form, and it's hard to, you know, people come against cognitive dissonance all the time.
Yeah. Right? Why do you think the concave earth is so suppressed? I mean, the information, the science is there. I mean, like the rectilinear experiment. Why do you think that's never been publicly reconducted since 1897?
Quite honestly, I think it would scare everybody. It would just be thinking that you're inside a sphere. You kind of feel more
claustrophobic.
Yeah, it's like claustrophobic. You know, you feel like you're in a prison, and if you know where the prison walls are, then you start going, "Why is it there? Why are the walls there? Who built this?"
Now, Damon,
I think that's something they don't really want anybody to know about. Essentially, that's probably why they're keeping it a big secret.
And also, there's like a paradigm between like what is actually reality versus what is fiction. And Damon, you're a writer, right? I mean, you write fiction, yeah. You write stories and stuff. And I think having this concept of holding on to this fictitious concept is like a form of denial, which actually allows your imagination to run wild and elaborate on things. You know, like, well, you know. We can talk about aliens, we can talk about parallel universes, we can talk about other worlds, we can talk about, you know, it's just kind of like your imagination can run wild.
Yeah, absolutely, and it creates huge industries as well. Think about Star Trek, and think about, like, Star Wars, and all the imaginative ideas of going out into space and traveling at hyperspeeds and visiting other planets, etc. When, if none of that's possible, that's going to create kind of a creative vacuum in people, and they may be,
right.
be find themselves very depressed. That's what I'm thinking. That they may just
I do.
They may just think, well, what's the point? We can't get out of this thing. And
right. It's almost like like when I was in prison, I would have the greatest dreams. You know, it's like I was stuck in a cell here, but I'm having these awesome, vivid, elaborative dreams of, you know.
Well, yeah,
your and stuff.
Capacity for the human mind to want freedom and to want like the boundless, you know, the expanse of the universe to be out there, able to be explored, is something that you can't easily quell, and you're not going to be able to like just come out and say this, and hopefully people are just going to not riot and not, you know, or not just be depressed and stop working and
but
the economy, etc. So it's, I think that's a big incentive for keeping it a secret.
I think, but I think there needs to be a healthy balance. I think people still can have this vivid imagination of what, you know, what their mind can produce as far as like fiction or fantasy, but you really need to be grounded in the truth and the reality in which we live in, you know, the earth in which we live in. And I think,
well, absolutely.
Yeah,
I agree.
So there's like this, you know, there's this denial mechanism that's deeply, deeply indoctrinated ever since, you know, the Copernican Revolution, really. And it's just like completely shuts out any concept of concave earth. You know, when I talk to people in, you know, in person, some people just feel very depressed about this. So, oh no, we're living in this prison. Like you said, we're living in this prison. How about you, John? Did you find that with people too? Do they find it depressing to think that we're living in the concave earth? Or?
No, but I'd like to expand on the thought at hand here. if indeed the Earth does not rotate, we now have a collapse, a first domino, if you will, that starts to fall on every single thing in science.
That's right.
The dates, the millions of years, the trillions of years, the age of the universe, everything starts to topple. You have problems with evolution because you need all these millions of years.
Right.
All dating systems, all these sciences that depend on the Earth's motion.
Exactly. Exactly. And their foundation, just like the legs are knocked right out from under them. It's that foundation of the premise of the Earth rotating. It's just, you know, I actually, there's a, you know, the Wild Heretic, right? And you guys have seen his site before. He's got a maxim at the top of his page. It says, when you have eliminated all which is impossible, then whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And so, like, there's basically, I would say, four different models of the universe. First, you have the generally accepted heliocentric model, where we have a convex spinning Earth, and it's orbiting around the sun in a vast universe, and stars are light years away. However, when people start realizing, you know, there's no spin to the Earth, you know, we can go into the Sagnac experiment, we can go into Michelson-Morley, we can go into Aries' failure, we can show how the Foucault pendulum has problems with it with Maurice Elias, you know, showing that during eclipses the pendulum changes rotation. There's no proof whatsoever that there's any rotation to the Earth. So if we knock out that initial model of the universe, then we have what? We have a convex geostationary Earth, which a lot of Bible believers believe in. You know, we have the Principal movie that came out over the past year, and, you know, people like that think that the Earth is the center of the universe and it's stationary. However, it's still convex. However, there's problems with that too once you get into the understanding that, okay, well, why, if you ascend high in an airplane, like 35,000 feet, why isn't the horizon lowering? Why is it still at your eye level? If you were on a convex ball, I even did simulations in 3D, the horizon would be much lower, right? So, and there's other problems too. It's like, well, you have this geostationary Earth in the center, and so you're saying the sun is still 93 million miles away, right? And so this sun has to do one full revolution in a 24-hour period. You know, if you do 2 pi r, the circumference of a circle, you're talking about over like 500,000 miles in one day, and that's just the sun. Then you have the stars, which are even supposedly further away, like 300 million light years or whatever, how many light years away. You can't, that's asinine. You cannot complete a light year in a day. It just doesn't make any sense. And so there's a lot of problems with a geocentric convex model of the Earth. And then, of course, then, you know, this whole flat Earth baloney that seems to be popping up on YouTube, that's baloney too. I mean, they can't map out the heavens, for one thing. The celestial sphere up in the sky, they have to conclude that it's a hologram or something, because we have two pole stars, the North Pole stars and South Pole stars, that have axes, or have axes. You know, they're showing that there's a sphericity to the heavens, and so they can't map that out within a flat Earth paradigm. Amongst other things, you know, the distances in the southern hemisphere, they still coordinate to spherical coordinates. I don't care if you show me a plane flight that takes its route from South Africa to Dubai and then back to Australia. It's, if you take a direct route from, let's say, South Africa to Auckland, New Zealand, it's still it can be as fast as 13 hours, 14 hours. You can't not fit that on a flat Earth pizza with the crust being Antarctica. It just doesn't work. So there's many problems with that. Also, too, like I from an artistic point of view, I'm an artist, and aesthetically, yeah, look at this flat Earth map. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, you have like Africa, like the Horn of or the Cape of Africa and the South America. They're like bloated out, like they have gout or something. It just doesn't make any sense. And so the fourth model is the concave model. So it's I've eliminated the first three models, and there's no problems with, if you understand that light is bending upwards. And a lot of people ask, okay, well, if the Earth is concave, why can't we see the other side? Well, that's not how light works. I mean, Wild Heretic has some great articles about light bending upwards. So the curvature of this light, this line of sight, it's not a line, it's actually a curved trajectory, is hitting the stars. It's you're, when you look When you look across, you see the sun setting at the horizon. It's actually not a straight line. It's actually a curved trajectory, and so it's curving up like that. And so when we cannot see the other side because of the visibility limitation of curved light. And so that's what I'd like to present to people, is that, you know, you just eliminate the impossible. What's left, however improbable, must be the truth. What do you guys think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's too many things in relativity that just people have to take for fanciful nonsense. Like the thought experiment of the barn door thing. Have you heard of that one at all?
The thought experiment with the barn door?
Yeah, the barn door experiment, where supposedly you run at the speed of light, you have a pole that's longer than the two doors on either side of the thing. But since you're running at the speed of light, your pole is gonna shrink. So when the front of the
time barn door
closes, yeah. And then the back of the barn door closes, the pole will fit inside.
See, that's all theoretical hogwash.
Well, I don't understand how they can make that assumption when there's been no evidence of anything shrinking in science.
Well, yeah. That is the great special theory of relativity.
Yeah.
The necessary nonsense, if you will, that is required to keep the Earth in motion.
Yeah,
I mean, they used it to say the interferometer of the Michelson-Morley experiment,
right.
The left arm shrunk. And then, this bothers me a lot. They all over the internet, they tell you Einstein can never be disproven. How they say this is just preposterous. The man comes up with an idea based on the contraction theories. Doesn't have to prove it, and instead says that the Michelson-Morley experiment is the proof. But where did they actually show that? Where's the measurement to prove that the left arm actually shrunk?
It's not.
Right.
Yeah,
so we have an inherent problem that people just don't understand.
Yeah, they just universally accept. It must be. I mean, we cannot entertain this, that the Earth is not spinning. We have to come up with some other answer. So let's Einstein to the rescue, or the Lorentz contraction to the rescue. And it's crazy. And
it does take a lot of faith to believe that kind of thing. I mean, really, when there's a much more rational explanation, and that's just that we're not moving at all.
It definitely does.
You know,
go ahead.
Well, if we wrap in the idea, you know, I just want to bring in the atheist perspective for a second. They are dependent upon the scientific method of showing proof to claims. And this is basically the system that the atheists use to figure out if, you know, God exists. And they'll argue, okay, well, where's your proof? And you don't have evidence, and you're making assumptions. But when it comes to these sciences, they're not applying the same rules. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even the atheist has to reconsider the way they're thinking about things.
Yeah.
You guys, you know, you're with me on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to even tell them, hey, you're being blindsided when it comes to science also. You're just accepting authority and other fallacies that exist.
Yeah, it's a confirmation bias with this ad populum mentality that modern so-called science is their gospel. You know, it's right. And we went to the moon. NASA's 100% correct. You know, everything they say is gospel to them. I mean, it's just a substitution. Their God is substituted instead of this, you know, the God of the Bible. It's the God of science, and or so-called science, falsely so-called. So it's hypocritical.
I think it's easy to believe this stuff when you see it packaged in a pretty package, like the, you know, the Nova episodes and, you know, all the things that they put out with all these pretty graphics and stuff. It's easy to just get swept into it and believe exactly what they're telling you. And it just comes in at a conscious level, because while you're looking at these pretty pictures, you know, they're telling you about all these lies.
Yeah, it's hypnotic. I mean, yeah, you just sit there and watch the Nova Channel, and you look at the meteors and exploding in space and everything. It's just, wow. It's like, yeah, we know this is CG, this is fabricated, but, you know, subconsciously we're absorbing this. Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah, it becomes a reality for you. It's like a predict. It's just a thing that they put into your brain. It's a programming device. They use these pretty images quite often.
Fiction is more sexy than the truth, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sad to say, but...
Oh, I don't know about that. I think the truth is what got me to Concave Earth in the first place, which is far more interesting.
Fair enough. Good enough. That's fine with me.
Entertaining, though, to be lied to, I think. And people generally like to be lied to. That's why Hollywood's such a big success. That's why TV programming is called programming. It's why, you know, it's a cycle of programming, basically. That's all it is they're implanting their mindset. That's what they want you to believe so that you don't question. Why we're here? Why is there a prison wall around us? Who built this machine, etc.? You know?
Yeah, I hear you.
Because they want you asking those kind of questions. Those kind of questions are dangerous, especially if they can control the central sphere. Then they can basically control a panopticon, if you will, of absolute control. And they don't.
Right. Yeah.
Need to explain that if nobody knows about it. You know what I mean? My opinion, I think that's what's happening. If you own and occupy that central sphere, you have a central location where you can spy and look upon every part of the world. It's a panopticon theory, essentially. And if you can occupy that space, and I think that they've been trying to with the nuclear weapons in space, with Operation Fishbowl.
Yes.
And all the space trying to get there, now with portals trying to get up there with CERN.
I think
that's definitely one of their goals, is trying to occupy the space, because it must be a very powerful location.
Yeah, so you think they're trying to get up in the middle of the earth there, middle of the heaven. Let's talk about the glass sky a little bit. What do you guys think about that?
I think it makes sense. I was just reading some article. I forget who posted it, but I think it may have been you, John, where you posted something about zero-G glass. It was formed in space. It's more transparent than any glass you can trade here that's metallic.
Oh, yeah, NASA had an article about that, didn't they?
That was a very intriguing article. That they want to go up there and create that stuff in zero G would be.
Well, that would make sense too. Yeah, I mean, if this glass was formed in where there's supposedly no gravity, I mean, it's going to be a lot more transparent than glass formed here on the surface of the Earth, because of the. I guess there's more viscosity up where there's no gravity. I hate to use that word gravity, but you know, where there's no gravity.
Well, in the space in the ethereal, I'm sure where it's not, well, you know, you say the things in your model, Stephen. You've got satellites in geosynchronous orbits, etc. So yeah. I'm curious, like in geostationary. Mm-hmm. So you think those are places where you could achieve what we would equivalent to zero G?
Well, I'm not definitely saying that. I'm not sold on it, but I'm trying to make sense of it all. I'm inclined to think that they did penetrate the glass firmament and launched some kind of satellites. I talk about there's actually supposedly there's four equatorial equilibrium points within the ocean. And it's kind of interesting that we have four points. You know, obviously my model has this octahedron in the middle of the celestial sphere, and so if it's emanating magnetically, these four points extending it outwards toward the Earth, it could be this equilibrium zone, or these equilibrium zones that are actually allowing whatever objects that fall within that region to actually just kind of levitate there. So I think it's a possibility. I'm not saying it's definite, but
well, that would follow then. If actual glass is being formed there, metallic glass that's more transparent than anything, it would follow.
Well, yeah. I mean, and, you know, the whole concept of space being a vacuum. I mean, glass would be a very good container to contain that vacuum of space, and you know.
Yep.
Of course, you have the auroras, and you know. Just like on a plasma ball, which has glass encasing it, you know, you can create an electric discharge forming the auroras with the plasma. So a lot of good, you know, I bring up a lot of different reasons why. I mean, the whole idea of rainbows in the first place, sunlight being dispersed through the glass and the different wavelengths of the different colors going through at different speeds. And so they refract differently. Red has the least amount of refraction, and violet has the most, and so it creates the spectrum, And I believe the whole reason why we have the bow is because the sun, the rim of the sun, extends almost like if you just shine a flashlight, and you're gonna have a rim to it. And so, a lot of good reasons to believe that there is glass in the sky. And so, when you have that understanding, then these mysteries that modern science cannot understand, fathom, where the like mega cry meteors, where are they coming from? Well, if you have this glass ceiling.
Does open up a lot of like explanations. I mean, even just historical stuff. When you start thinking about, like, because you have the octahedron in the middle, and it's made of, you said, magnetite, right? Or is that?
I'm not sure what it. I mean, this is all speculation on my part. I don't. But I think it's magnetic. Yeah, I think
well, it has to be magnetic. I'd imagine to be like, because it would fit the model, even on their model, because they say we have a highly magnetic core.
Yeah.
When if the core is in the sky and it's highly magnetic and it's an octahedron. Which is the crystal habit of magnetite.
Exactly.
It is magnetic on Earth.
Exactly.
And if it's a massive structure, that would follow. It seems that you could actually make that argument as well, since especially you can find plenty of articles and things about pyramidal energy and levitation.
Yep.
And other
Joe
aspects.
Parr.
This is suspended in the middle of the air and have, you know, it's possible.
Yeah, I don't. I made a video about, you remember, you guys know Joe Parr? He was a pyramid researcher, and he did studies on the pyramids, and he found out that there's a spherical energy bubble that surrounds pyramids. I think he had the pyramids actually rotating. And so, I mean, you have this concept of a sphere encapsulating a pyramid, and so that's essentially what we have with the heavens and the earth. You know, we have a series of concentric spheres that are covering this central octahedron or pyramid, which is levitating. And so
I think that icon, the pyramidal icon, just appears. I mean, it's beyond coincidence at this point that it's appearing everywhere in the world. Obviously, somebody knew about that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, yeah, you know, the Illuminati symbolism is pretty much everywhere, but.
Which is why it leads me to believe that in the panopticon idea, that there's basically this prism that you have absolute visible.
Well, that's the whole idea of the eye watching, you know, the eye of God.
Exactly. The all seeing eye.
All seeing eye is watching.
That's the paradigm of it. And seeing
if it's right in the middle, there's your panopticon. It's right there. Yeah. Exactly.
It's an interesting concept. I wonder if they've actually made it inside the sphere at this point, or if they. Failed.
I don't think they can get that high. I think, you know, you guys remember that that article that came out a couple months ago about the Star Trek wall?
Yes.
You know, the Van Allen belts, and it's almost like these electrons are hitting a glass wall. Well, yeah, they are. Yeah. So recently, I actually revised my model to include these concentric glass spheres. I think there's possibly more than one glass sphere now. So if you have these glass walls, you know, it's going to be pretty hard to get through, especially with all the radiation. So I don't think they can get up there. I think they might try. What do you guys think about? Go ahead.
Do you think they can get there?
What's the highest?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think they can get past the first glass.
100 kilometer Kármán line, 62 miles.
Yeah, something like that. But it's all speculation on my part. I don't know. You know, it's just, I just got to go with what, you know, just make.
We have to go on videos where they're telling us exactly what's happening. But I mean, I think that maybe we've gotten past that first layer at some point.
And, yeah.
Know if we can get further. I'm kind of curious how the Van Allen belts would work inside the concentric spheres. If it's basically just radiation that's coming around as the sun's rotating around. Is it just the energy that it's projecting outward, and it's too hot to get through?
I don't know. I think the sun does play a part in it. I'm not really sure though. I couldn't. I'd have to think about that more. But
yeah. I was just kind of curious. The Van Allen belts have that torus shape all the way around the Earth. You know,
so they say
the model, but it could be translated in the internal as well.
Yeah. Well, then you have the auroral zones that, you know, over.
It's basically just being the heat that is generated as light is going around.
Right. Over the Arctic and the Antarctic, they have these auroral zones, which actually I think that I have my model. I have this outer rind to the Earth. I believe it's made out of metal, and there's possibly these openings in the north and south, which has been covered over with plates, you know, with basalt or continental plates. but I believe that's why we have the actual rural zones.
Do you think there's portals out at the poles?
I think there might be some small ones. I don't think it's some. I mean, you know, we. If you ever watched any Hollow Earth, you know, convex Hollow Earth propaganda, they
Sure, like the
should.
cards and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that's all, and that's all fantasy baloney. And then Bird's Diary is a forgery and stuff. But anyway, I'm not sure if, you know, I think a lot of that imagery is photoshopped or whatever. But I think it's very possible that there might be a few small portals in the north and the south, possibly. I think even Wild Heretic mentions that too, that he thinks there are some. And within this closed system, you would think you would need some kind of heat escape as well.
Yeah,
So it's.
absolutely. Well, what about the polar vortex? I was wondering. I'm actually kind of thinking of a theory, maybe that the Norse people have talked about tall whites. Like basically, they describe the tall white alien type race, basically the tall giant types and the ice giants. And looking at it, kind of an interesting like, what if they're surface dwellers, kind of, and that's their weapon is their polar vortex that they can send in, just from the esoteric nonsense point of view. I'm just kind of, as a writer and fanciful
Right.
thinking.
I don't, yeah, I mean, we can guess.
Yes,
I personally think that, you know, once you get outside of Earth, there's nothing. I mean, a lot of people always ask me, well, what's on the outside? Are there multiple Earth spheres? Are there, you know, are there, I say, I don't think there's anything. I think this is it. I mean, but I could be wrong, but, you know, scripture says that the Earth is hung on nothing, Job chapter 26. It also talks about being kicked out of the earth in Job chapter 38, and its outer darkness and a bottomless pit. And so this could be the extent of our physical world, you know. And so what we have is, you know, like we talked about initially, is that we have this vivid imagination. Would you like to conjure up?
Absolutely. I'm still trying to dream the creative out there. But I want, if even in the concave earth, I don't want to be limited.
Yeah, it's kind of like I make the comparison. It's like your brain is this mass. It's just like this 5-pound mass inside your cranium, but it has the capacity to like expound and to elaborate and to imagine these wild and vivid fantasy reality or so-called realities. And so, but in essence, it's still just a brain. So I think like the concave earth is like the brain, and so we have this imagination. We like to think of these vivid universes, and you know, I think the whole parallel universe is a bunch of crack. You know, it's just it's a cop out. It's kind of a hypocritical cop out for atheists to actually entertain this idea, this notion. I think I that one scientist, his name was Charles Lawrence, whatever, he talked about, well, I like the parallel universe idea because it excludes God from the equation. And the whole idea is basically because they have to admit that this so-called universe is so perfectly fine-tuned, everything is working in synchronization and everything. Well, there's got to be other universes by chance, right? By random chance, that are not so perfectly fine-tuned. So it's like, well, no, that's
You
just.
could have an infinite, and then anything's possible, obviously. You can just create anything you want to make things up out of whole cloth.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
Yeah.
that's the thing about that. That's why that theory is the standing theory, is because people, they really want to believe that stuff. They think that we're some, just a random universe.
Yeah, exactly.
Is
There's
that
a little pale blue dot. When I talked to Richard Cohen, the NASA scientist, he even admitted, he was talking with his colleague, and he's like, he called me back after I initially told him about the concave Earth, and he was like, you know, you got a point there, Steve. I mean, the concave Earth is more credible than the parallel universe or string theory, because, you know, you have cold hard facts. You know, you have
I think so.
experimentation, you have the rectilinear, you have the tamarack mine shafts. And there's no reason not to seriously understand or consider the concave Earth, and especially because in light of what I say, what I believe will happen, because within the stationary Earth, you have the sun moving. And if you read about it in legends, they talk about a time where the sun actually stopped a long time ago, about 3,500 years ago. It's mentioned in scripture too, in Joshua chapter 10. So if that's going to happen again, you know, I have this doomsday scenario. If there's this, you know, if we have this origin, we know where the ice is coming from, the top of the glass sky, and the ice falls when the sun stops. It's recorded in Joshua 10. The sun stops and the ice falls. And especially if NASA's been poking holes for these, through the glass sky, and it's been jarring loose chunks of ice from time to time. Maybe that's why I believe they're actually spraying chemtrails, is to actually contain the man-made anthropogenic heat from rising. So they have all these chemicals in the chemtrails that are actually the same chemicals that are used in apparatus to suppress fire. So I believe it's like this endothermic blanket. They don't want another Tunguska, because I talk about how, Tunguska was probably just a large chunk of ice that fell down a long time ago, because there's no it's a mystery to them, because there's no evidence of any meteors or anything. So you have this scenario, this doomsday scenario with this kind of universe. That's scary. It's scary to a lot of people, but
You think if when the sun stopped, that the ancient people actually had seen the mechanism at the center of the sky, and that's why these myths of pyramids and the
Oh,
eyeballs, et cetera, have appeared in our, and
I
the
don't
Mayan
know.
calendar, for example, like
I don't know.
that
I
seems to be
think, yeah,
a
what
map
I
part of
think
it.
the whatever you want to call them, the Anunnaki or the Nephilim or whatever, I think they had knowledge of the pyramid. When the sons of God got kicked out of heaven, they came down to earth. I think they had the blueprints, the knowledge. That's why the way that they can build the Pyramid of Giza with such accuracy. And so I think that there's, pre-flood civilization had a greater understanding, a greater first-hand knowledge of what was up there. The sons of God, it talks about in Job 38, the sons of God shouted for joy when they built the foundations of the earth, and they talk about laying a cornerstone on the top. And so you have this knowledge of that they brought down with them. And so that's what I think anyway.
Well, sure. I mean, to go along with sort of what you're saying, a little bit different. You know how all the ancient civilizations have depictions of Saturn, and you have the Saturn pagan style religion, the god of Saturn and stuff like this?
Right.
With the glass sky, as you say, it was formed after the flood. It's the opposite of the canopy theory,
Yes.
and what that glass guy does is it basically helps block a barrier. I think it was much more clearer back then before the glass sky was formed, so these people actually can see Saturn. Because Saturn is also referred to as a sun. They called
Interesting.
that the second sun in some of these civilizations. You have the Sumerians, they can see all the planets quite clearly. So I think that glass guy, with whatever refringences or whatever there is for optical change, has distorted the view,
Yeah.
so it seems like everything's so far away now.
Yeah, I even actually considered whether or not pre-flood, before the glass sky, we could actually see more of the land, curving upward, or maybe we can see across the other side of the earth. But it's just conjecture, but I think it's very possible. But with that glass sky, it changed a lot. I mean, there's records, and there's fossils of giants, 10, 14, 20 feet tall, and then you look at some of the blocks on the pyramid, or the blocks of Stonehenge, and you get the
Yeah,
understanding
megalithic
that
stone.
the
Baalbek
megaliths,
stone.
that people were much bigger, much stronger, they lived longer. Scripture and Genesis, they talk about people living up to 969 years. And so what I came to understand is that, well, it might just a matter of process of deduction, is basically that within a hyperbaric atmosphere, where there's a greater amount of oxygen, those conditions are possible, where you can live longer and you are stronger and you're bigger. You look at, when they show you comparison of vegetables, like a 20-pound tomato that was grown under hyperbaric conditions versus just a regular tomato. And so pre-flood, I believe, without that glass sky, I believe that there was a higher, well, we have nitrogen and oxygen in the atmosphere predominantly, but mostly it's nitrogen, and nitrogen is lighter than oxygen. It's a 7 versus an 8. And so I believe pre-flood that this nitrogen was staying comfortably above the oxygen, and so all the oxygen was really close to the ground. It was not diluted with the nitrogen. And so, but after the glass sky formed, it actually compressed all that nitrogen at the top and mixed it in with the oxygen. So we have a Now we have a lower amount of oxygen, and everything is more compressed, and so that's my theory about why We can't live as long, we can't grow as big, you know, we can't get as strong after the flood.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, even in football, they put them in the chambers for, you know, those oxygen chambers to try to promote healing,
yeah,
things like that. And, you know, we got those people walking around with the oxygen tanks, stuff like that. So, I mean, it makes sense, you know, and this is just one of the things that people got to understand. I mean, once you get past certain basic foundational concepts, you can start moving on and more things make sense than before.
Yeah.
You know, just like as we're explaining. So, I mean, it'd be great if more people would have an open mind.
Yeah, I think I think we're slowly making progress. We got some good YouTubers out there. Joseph Winthrop, he's going out there and he's actually making, he's going out with a laser and he's surveying the land. He's showing that, you know, it's impossible to have this convex earth, or even a flat earth for that matter. And so it's, and I welcome, you know, maybe this can be like the first installment of more sessions to come with other people as well. And, you know, we can just grow from there. But,
well, I think as far as progress in concave Earth goes, if we look back at cellular cosmology, or cosmogony, is the book from Cyrus Teed and the Corinthians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the concepts were trying to be worked out, and I think today we have. I mean, imagine if we had as many scientists working on concave Earth as we have for the heliocentric model. There would be so much more things answered already.
Yeah.
And we've only seen the progression over the last 100 years plus of concave Earth theory being more solidified and making more and more sense. And then we don't have to scratch our heads when new scientific data comes out like the heliocentrists.
Yeah.
They're always getting this data and wondering how it fits in their model.
Yeah.
You know, we see the data and we say, well, that just backs up what we're already saying. And, you know, you do this a lot on YouTube as well.
Yeah, well, to me, I just have to guess is that the power structures within each country, they know the Earth is concave, but it's like they purposely keep this stuff secretive for whatever reason. You know, one, it's not a money-making, you know, model. Two, it's too scary for the public to realize this, you know. So, three, you have all these dignitaries, all these luminaries in science, you know, you have Neil deGrasse Tyson and all people like that. That would be totally ridiculed. Yeah. So it's like there's no incentive really for the public to embrace this truth. But, you know, within my eschatological understanding, you know, it's you don't have much choice in the end, because, you know, we're on a time schedule here. You know, things are going to start happening, so this shit's going to hit the fan soon. So it's really a wake-up call for people to get with the program. You know, you guys want to continue living in La La Land, fantasy land, and take that blue pill and go to sleep, you know, or, you know, listen to me, listen to, you know, to you guys. And, you know, I just want to say I really appreciate you guys coming out, and, you know, John and Damien, you guys starting your own blogs here and going. We just talk about, you know, my friend McKelly, he's actually talking about putting together a production, a Concave Earth production. He's actually a movie producer, and so we're talking about putting that together, Damien, and he's helping with the script on that. So there's a lot of good things down the pike for people to believe in the truth, the reality. So,
what do you think is the single most asked question immediately in response to this, to presenting this theory to somebody that you guys have heard?
What's on the outside? I think that's the most. I don't know. What about you, John? What do you get asked?
Well, as far as answering something like what's on the outside, I ask them, well, why is the heliocentric space system finite instead of an infinite plane? sometimes you gotta.
It's gotta
ask
be an edge
the
somewhere,
question.
Right?
You gotta ask the questions back to them. Does it matter what's on the outside?
Yeah, exactly.
Because
it doesn't matter.
We can't prove that, so, you know, ultimately, it's not gonna matter. You know, I mean, this is where they can't prove things, and, you know, you guys talking about multi-dimensions, parallel universes, dark matter, which is basically the new ether, you know, linguistic placeholder for ether is dark matter. I mean, it's just all ridiculousness,
yeah.
You know, and it just gets more and more wild. Take one wrong idea and start compiling all new ideas that don't make any sense because they're all based on one wrong idea.
Exactly. It's like, they're just like putting Bondo on their car. Oh, okay, I'm going to fix this dent right here. Oh, no, there's another dent over here.
I think the main problem is the idea that the Earth is concave. You know, after you get past the Earth not being in any motion whatsoever, it's now the shape of the Earth that becomes an issue. And this is what the flat earthers struggle with. You know, they struggle with the rectilinear, and nobody will reproduce it. If you go onto my blog, you'll see what I call the legendary article, where they actually put up a challenge. They say, hey, you do your own geodactic survey. Prove us wrong.
Exactly.
And even to this day, all they can do is ridicule it, come up with, you know, erector sets and other stupid nonsense. It's the happy coincidences in science. It's a happy coincidence that the interferometer's arm shrunk just enough to not show the Earth's motion.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a happy coincidence that the rectilinear sags just enough.
Yes, exactly.
It's the exact measurements you would expect if the Earth was convex.
Exactly.
Except it's a happy coincidence to be concave.
Yeah.
So they call the information null, but there's data and there's proof.
Yeah.
So it's foolishness.
Yep.
You know, like I said, they are very scared that if these things are redone and proven and special relativity gets removed, the geodactic survey gets done again and defines the proof, they are so scared because all these sciences, like I explained before, have to change.
Yep.
Everything we know is wrong.
Exactly. Everything.
They're already sort of backpedaling when both the new Planck image, the Axis of Evil data, it basically says that we're kind of at the center of everything, which is kind of, you know, kind of blows the whole Big Bang out of the water, unless it happened, like, right here.
Exactly.
Well,
so that's a big crisis.
You saw my article that they put it on a ball, they mapped it out on a ball, which is, you know, Stephen put the Milky Way band on the celestial sphere where it belongs, and they also do the same exact thing.
Interesting.
Yes, indeed. There's no reason to believe where the Milky Way is a spiral galaxy. It's a band. It has a function. It actually, the CMB is showing a dipole. It's showing that this universe has has two hemispheres, and so the Milky Way band is actually dividing it, and there's two different opposing currents in each kind of hemisphere, and so you understand how the sun is operating, how this band or whatever, depending on what hemisphere the sun is, it's steering the sun either north or south, and so that's why we have this, you know, the cylindrical orbit of the sun, which actually oscillates and it moves up and north and south every 6 months, and so it performs a function. So everything just makes sense, and so
I think that's the thing about the concave theory is once you start embracing the concept, you really start to make sense of a lot of different aspects of mythology and science that can't be explained. It's just, it's kind of like a cascade of,
like
revelations at that point. You're just like, okay, I can see it. It makes sense now. And especially when seeing your graphics, the hard work that you put into that is like, it's immense because, I couldn't even imagine putting that all together. But it perfectly illustrates exactly what you can't really conceptualize when you're thinking about it just in terms of, this, it's kind of a nebulous concept of having spheres in the sky, et cetera, but when you see it actually working in your working model, it's inspiring, you can actually see the model.
I appreciate that. So, well, we're just
It's good work, man. You did excellent.
Thank you.
You deserve a lot of credit.
Well, I want to get the truth out there,
It's good that you're using your skills as an artist to to do that, because I think that it's a state, you know, it's science that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, well, I left the rat race of corporate graphics a long time ago. There's got to be a better reason for me having this ability, this talent, and so I'm going to put it to good use.
Well, it's awesome. It's awesome that you have the ability to grasp the complex math involved in that as well.
Well, I try. I'm not a mathematician, but
sure.
You have their math, and their math inverted is equally as acceptable, and they admit to this.
Yeah.
So all you're doing is basically inverting their math through diagrams. Yeah. And people need visual evidence, you know, and I mean, we could do a whole show on what the heck is wrong with heliocentrism, and I put an article to support like Wild Heretic and stuff like that with the seasons. Stephen makes the seasons on the concave Earth, and everything is exactly as it's observed from our perspective on Earth. We're seeing the Polaris always where it belongs. We're seeing the sun never going into a northern arc in the summertime. You know, it stays where it's supposed to be, and everything is working. In the heliocentric model, you can't explain the axis always pointing at Polaris, the sun's arc in proper locations, and it's supposed to be going 300 million kilometers in a travel.
Yeah.
Around an elliptical orbit around the sun. You can't show all these things and explain the seasons in any simple form, like a diagram, which the concave Earth can do without a problem.
Exactly. Or the moons, for that matter. Or the orbit, the motions of the moons, of the moon, I should say. It's like you have that graphic, one of your recent articles, Occam's Razor. You know, it's the simplest answer is the best answer. And so there's no reason to have this elliptical orbit of the moon, and the whole idea of tidal locking, and it's just like you said, it's a happy coincidence that the moon just happens to make one full rotation every orbit, and just it's so the face of the same face of the moon is always facing Earth. Yeah. Oh no, that's a little too coincidental, I think.
Your diagrams of the retrograde motions of the planets was excellent too. You can totally see how that. It's just basically a push-pull motion.
Yeah, I just went in Stellarium, and I just wrote down the right ascensions of the planets, and I just went into my 3D program and I just mapped them out, and so that's how they work, and so it's an accurate plotting of the planets, and it shows how the sun is affecting the planets. It's pushing and pulling them. It works out. So.
Yeah, and you're using their math. Aren't you?
Yeah, well, yeah. Using what's observed through, you know. I mean, there's no reason for me to, you know, recalculate what's already observed by astronomers, you know. It's like,
But that's what I mean. You need to have the axis rotating. You need to have it on a 23.5 degree axis. You need it to go around the sun in order to explain planetary retrograde and call it not actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the biggest problems they had when they were starting to get into heliocentrism versus geocentrism. It's just one of the things that, I mean, at that time, it may have helped heliocentrism, but at this time, we don't have to say that's not real. We say that data is real, and we have the reason why.
Right.
Yep.
Exactly. That's great. We had a great talk here. It's going over an hour now, but we should do this again, and we'll invite other people as well. And so,
absolutely, presented a bit of evidence for people to look into this episode.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Well, look for the link. I'll shoot you guys the link, and you guys have a great evening, guys.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Nice
you
to meet you, Joe.
Take care, buddies.
Damon, you too.
Bye. Yeah,